From C-Cube Studios in Schenectady, New York, this is episode 4 of Little Brother for December 23rd, 2000. My name is Chuck Ritter and I'll be your host. In this episode of Little Brother, we'll talk to you about low power FM being killed by Congress. We'll talk to you about 10-digit dialing and much, much more. So stay tuned because Little Brother's about to tell on Big Brother. Hello, and thanks for tuning in to episode 4 of Little Brother. And really, folks, all I can say is, wow, I'm just completely floored by the way this thing has taken off. Right now we're heard on 3 radio stations, WRPI in Troy, New York, KPAH in Pahrump, Nevada, and Free Radio Santa Cruz in Santa Cruz, California, which is, of course, a micropower station. We're also heard on the web in several places. Each one of the 3 stations I just mentioned has got a website with live streaming audio, WRPI.org, ParumpRadio.com, and microradio.org/FRSC. So we can also be heard at RadioForAll.net, and that's our primary distribution site, by the way. And there are so many people to thank, so I'm going to just give a quick shout-out, of course, to Tim at WRPI, to V-Man, Eon Blues, and Skidmark Bob at Free Radio Santa Cruz, and Harvey out in the desert at KPAH. I'd like you to know also that if you like this show, please feel free to tape it, reproduce it, put it on CD, MP3, or whatever other format you might happen to have at your disposal, and get it out far and wide. Get this program out as far as it will go. You're welcome to copy it, reuse it, rebroadcast it, whatever you choose to do with it. Just all I ask is that if you do, please send me an email. My email address is cjritter@nycap.rr.com, and I will be repeating that email address later on in the show. If you didn't copy that down, that's okay. Send me an email. Let me know that you're using the program. And without further ado, I give you episode 4 of Little Brother. Federal regulators are weighing a controversial proposal to convert the entire country to 10-digit telephone dialing from the present mixed system of 7, 10, and 11-digit dialing. Presently, in areas where 7-digit dialing is in effect, any number in the local area code can be dialed by its last 7 digits, and calls placed to another area code must be dialed as 1 plus the area code and number. In some areas, however, a single metro area will have multiple area codes. New York City is one such area, with Manhattan being served by area codes 212, 646, and 917, and the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, and Staten Island being served by area codes 718 and 347. Under a 7-digit dialing system, you might have to dial your next-door neighbor on one side with 7 digits, but to reach your neighbor on the other side, you need to dial 11 digits. Under a 10-digit dialing system, both of these calls would be 10 digits in length. The disadvantages to going to a 10-digit dialing system are obvious. You need to educate the users to dial 10 rather than 7 or 11 digits, and you need to reprogram CBXs across the country in areas currently served by 7-digit dialing. The advantages might not be so clear, so here they are. First, 10-digit dialing will make it possible for a person from one area of the country to use a phone someplace else in the country without first having to ask how the phones work in that area, because all of the phones will work the same. Second, new exchanges, beginning with ones and zeros, can be used, releasing more phone numbers to the public and staving off the need to make phone numbers even longer. Some areas of the country, such as the Greater Seattle area, have already moved to 10-digit dialing. Last month, the city of Virginia Beach got a surprise letter from Microsoft Corporation demanding that they take inventory of their software and provide Microsoft with proof that all of the software was properly purchased and licensed. This month, the city completed its inventory, and being unable to find licenses for 826 of the 6,526 Microsoft products on their network of the 3,900 computer systems, sent Microsoft a check for $129,000. According to David Sullivan, the beach's chief information officer, the request said that they needed to provide an inventory and proof of purchase. Quote, "We felt like we couldn't find the documentation," end quote, he said. "And our inventory showed that it was in use, so we felt it was better to go ahead and fix it and be done with it than to battle it out over the year." The Virginian Pilot newspaper reports that Microsoft's contracts with customers reserves for Microsoft the right to ask customers for proof of purchase and inventory on demand. This rule applies not just to governments and large companies, but also to individuals. As a result of this action by Microsoft, the total cost to taxpayers is $210,000, $129,000 payment to Microsoft plus $81,000 in manpower costs to carry out the order. Now that the news item is out of the way, here's my commentary on the situation. First off, some of the reports suggest that perhaps Microsoft targets governments specifically because they generally buy from the lowest bidder. In this case, the lowest bidder could be making up his margin by failing to license properly the software installed on the computers sold to the city. Jedi Alex suggests on Slashdot that even though Virginia Beach may have had software legally, that perhaps the issue was one of organization, and decided that paying Microsoft off was less costly than trying to locate the missing licenses. Personally, I concur, because software licenses are odd shapes, sometimes attached to the CD, sometimes attached to the book, sometimes attached to the box, sometimes loose, and are very easily misplaced. Although I do not dispute Microsoft's right to pull off these audits, after all, each installation of the software required the installer to agree to the terms of the license and therefore bound the installer to the license, I must ask the question of whether or not it was right of Microsoft to do this. Just because they have the right doesn't make it right to do so. With the growing use of the Linux operating system, which is non-commercial in nature and does not tie the end user's hands with obscure licensing clauses, one must be left wondering just how much more of Microsoft's nonsense people will be willing to take before telling the Redmond Corporation to take a hike. Sam Beckett, also on Slashdot, suggests that it won't happen in government because Linux lacks two very important applications, Minesweeper and Solitaire. This next item comes to us from the Associated Press. The Federal Trade Commission, on Thursday, December 14th, unanimously approved the merger between both America Online and Time Warner, the largest in U.S. history, after the companies pledged to protect consumer choice for the next generation of Internet services and content. Thursday's decision clears the way for the Federal Communications Commission to complete its review, the final hurdle before the companies can consummate the $111 billion deal. But FTC approval moves the companies far along in their quest to complete a merger that they announced in January. The commission and the company settled on a series of conditions aimed at addressing competitive concerns raised by the merger. The agreement also set an important precedent for how the government will oversee the development of new web services like high-speed access and interactive television, both in their infancy. The commission voted 5-0 to approve the deal, even though some members had earlier expressed concerns about its competitive impact on consumers. Details of the agreement were not immediately available, but Federal Trade Commission scheduled an afternoon news conference to discuss the settlement. To assuage wary regulators, Time Warner had agreed to give consumers a choice of Internet providers besides AOL on its high-speed web access delivered over its cable lines. To fulfill that condition, Time Warner forged a deal last month to carry AOL's chief rival, Earthlink. Under its agreement with the FTC, the combined company must offer at least three Internet providers in addition to AOL within 3 months of offering service in a market. That's to ensure consumers could select from a variety of Internet providers in the high-speed online world, similar to the choices they already enjoy with traditional dial-up connections. AOL is the nation's largest online company with 26 million subscribers. In turn, AOL could deliver its service over Time Warner's extensive network of cable lines, capable of servicing nearly 21 million homes. The Federal Trade Commission has struggled for months with the unprecedented marriage of old and new media. AOL is associated with its wildly popular instant messaging service and other products. Media powerhouse Time Warner runs some of the best-known names in entertainment, including HBO and movies, and movies and music from Warner Brothers, and in journalism, such as CNN and Time Incorporated. Well, obviously, you can tell from the way that story reads that that was not written by a technical individual, and that's all right. I mean, point is that they're taking an interest in things technical. And this one actually does hit very close to home for me because due to the extreme incompetence of Verizon, I do presently have Time Warner as my internet service provider, and I would hate to see that. I would hate to see this particular merger cause a downhill slide in the quality of service I'm getting. On the flip side of it, I see this also as being equivalent to the situation that Verizon is in, where you have one company that owns the wire and offers service, but other companies that also offer service. It would seem to me like it would be highly likely that AOL might get preferential treatment, even if it's not at a documentable level, to say Earthlink and whoever else they may happen to offer. But only time will tell on this one. I really hate to say it. Well, no, I don't hate to say it. Time Warner seemed to be far more competent than Verizon are in trying to deal with this sort of thing. So I actually think that this may come out good. Only time will tell, though. So keep tuned. We'll keep you posted on this one. Now, check this out. We've actually got a piece of listener email here. And this came from Alex Ernst of Ravenna, New York. And he was writing in response to the last article in the last episode of Little Brother, where I was talking about the horrors of Verizon. In particular, I mentioned one person I know personally who had problems with his telephone service, and that the previous people there had at his apartment had never closed the service, and so he went 3 months. Yes, he was getting three free phone service, but he could not actually get a hold of his phone number. And I had suggested that dialing 997 or 998 would reveal the phone number to him, and that does work anywhere where Verizon is served. Alex comes from an area that's served by state telephone, and the 997 and 998 trick don't actually work there, although there may be another code somewhere that if anybody knows, please feel free to send it to me. Anyway, Alex writes, "Can't find your phone number? Dial 911 and ask them. They may get upset at you for frivolous use, but hey, it only takes a few of their precious seconds, and we'll all go on with our lives." And now my response to that, of course, is that I really wouldn't advise using 911 simply to find out what your phone number is. Yes, it's true. They do know what your phone number is when you dial into them, because they do use automatic number identification, or ANI, and that bypasses any block that might exist on the caller ID service. However, the thing to bear in mind is that some may look at this as an opportunity to punish the phone company, but in actuality you'd be punishing local officials, as the emergency 911 call centers are usually operated by the county government. And I've actually been inside one of these places. These places are terribly, terribly busy. So I really strongly advise against that, but we'll move on. "As long as the government allows megaphone companies to ruin service, it'll continue that way. Remember Lily Tomlin would do her phone company skit saying, 'We're the phone company, we don't have to care.'" Well, I'm afraid you're right, and as I said last week, I'm a bit upset about the fact that these companies, after they were forced to split into a whole bunch of different pieces, are now being allowed to reconverge. And the terms of the reconvergence were that there had to be some sort of competition established between phone companies. And yes, you can get in a Verizon area. I can't speak for state telephone. It is a very small company. It only covers two exchanges in area code 518, those being exchanges 756 and 731. But in an area that is served by Verizon, you do have a choice. You can get your telephone service from Verizon. You can get it from Mettel. You can get it from Sprint. You can get it from ACC Long Distance. You can get it from a whole bunch of different companies. And consequently, you do get a whole bunch of people calling you up asking you to switch your local service to this company, that company, or the other company. I've actually, in the past, usually when I've received one of these calls, I've sat down and gone down the bill with them item by item and shown them how they won't actually save me any money, which really annoys them. And it does take a telemarketer out of circulation for about a half hour so he's not annoying somebody else. But I'm digressing here. The thing of it is, yes, you do get your choice of who services your phone line, but in actuality, Verizon still owns the wires, and whoever it is, whoever your local telephone company is, they get all of the flack for dealing with your lines, while Verizon is actually the one controlling the maintenance of those lines. And it's really not a fair situation. At any rate, I do take listener letters, and I should probably have announced this in previous shows. If you want to write me, the email address, I have a new email address here. The address is cjritter, C-J-R-I-T-T-E-R, at nycap.rr.com. And NYCAP is N-Y-C-A-P. That stands for New York Capital District. That email address again, cjritter at nycap.rr.com. So please feel free to send me your letters. Make money fast. Free XXX shows online. Win, win, win. These are just some of the messages that assail email users on a daily basis. Unsolicited commercial email, or as it's more often called, spam, is sent out to try to drum up business conducted by shady characters with anonymous Dropbox mailing addresses, unlisted phone and fax numbers, and email addresses that trace back to nowhere. It's a very expensive problem, irritating more than a few people, clogging up corporate networks, wasting residential customers' online time, and exposing minors to content that they really need not see. Jason Guerin, 46, of Orange County, California, pled guilty on Friday, December 8th, to charges of second-degree forgery for utilizing the computer network of Market Vision Graphics Studio to send out millions of anonymous emails, which traced back falsely to IBM.com, advertising pornography, and get-rich-quick schemes. His efforts cost Market Vision about $18,000 and lost productivity when their network crashed. This case is believed to be one of the first in the country for internet forgery, and he faces up to 7 years in prison for his efforts. According to SecurityFocus.com, a sophisticated hacker took command of a large portion of Washington Medical Center's internal network earlier this year and downloaded computerized admission records for 4,000 heart patients. The intrusions began in June and continued until at least mid-July before the network administrators at Seattle Teaching Hospital detected the hacker and cut him off. The medical center was purportedly unaware that patient records were being downloaded and elected not to notify law enforcement agencies of the intrusions. Kane, the 25-year-old Dutch hacker behind this hack, stated that this is a story of great incompetence, that all the data taken was taken via the internet, and that there were no firewalls of any sort in place. SecurityFocus.com reviewed parts of the databases that the hacker had downloaded and discovered that the downloaded data included catalogs of names, addresses, birth dates, social security numbers, heights and weights of over 4,000 cardiology patients and 700 physical rehabilitation patients, and a chronicle of every admission, discharge, and transfer during a 5-month period. A hospital spokesman would only state that this incident is under investigation. In a landmark ruling with potential implications for web surfers around the world, a French court on Monday ordered U.S. internet giant Yahoo to bar French users from sites selling Nazi memorabilia. Judge Jean-Jacques Gomez confirmed a ruling that he first issued on May 22nd, ordering Yahoo to prevent people from France from accessing the English-language sites that auction Nazi books, daggers, SS badges, and uniforms. He had stayed the decision, pending testimony from three computer experts on whether the ruling was technically viable. Gomez ordered Yahoo to conform with the findings of the panel submitted on November 6th that a filter system registering keywords could block access to the offending sites for 90% of French web servers. He gave the California-based company 90 days to enact the measures and said it would be fined 100,000 francs, or $13,000, for each day it exceeded the deadline. The case was brought to court by the Paris-based International League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism and the Union of French Jewish Students. A third French anti-racist group joined the action at a later stage. Gomez upheld their complaint that Yahoo had to respect French laws prohibiting the exhibition or sale of objects that incite racial hatred. The ruling could have implications for other big U.S. internet businesses with global reach, such as the e-tailer Amazon.com and online auctioneer eBay. Yahoo had fought the case primarily on the grounds that its English-language Yahoo.com services are U.S. governed and that auctions of Nazi material cannot be barred because of U.S. constitutional rights to freedom of speech. Yahoo's French-language portal Yahoo.fr does not host such auctions, but French surfers, like all others, can switch over to Yahoo.com services with the click of a mouse. It had also argued that there was no fail-safe way to identify French surfers and block access. Three web security experts told the court earlier this month that a filtering system could work by testing the so-called Internet Service Provider address of the web surfers, as well as the keywords they used. They said such a system would work for up to 90% of users. One member of the team, Vince Cerf of the U.S., said at the time that he believed that the move was contrary to the very idea of a World Wide Web, an electronic galaxy where information and ideas were exchanged with no physical borders. And with the news out of the way, here's my comment on it. It only seems natural that Vint Cerf would feel that way about it. He is, after all, the inventor of the TCP/IP protocol, which holds together the Internet as it stands right now. It's really kind of a ridiculous ruling. I think that the French court is entirely out of its jurisdiction to try to impose restrictions on a U.S. company, although it's not without precedent for a given nation, and China, of course, is the first one that comes to mind on this, not without precedent for a nation to block access to certain types of data from crossing the border via the Internet. If they decide that Yahoo should be the entity responsible for blocking this access, then my personal thought on the matter is that it would really be very simple. Since they've got it figured out how to locate 90% of, or how to identify 90% of French users, the obvious thing to do would be for Yahoo to simply block out all access from French users to Yahoo.com and put up a notice saying that this site has been blocked due to a French court order. The reason why I would suggest this particular approach as opposed to just blocking some of the content is, as we've spoken before about filtering software and keyword detection software, it will frequently miss, especially if, in this particular case, let's say the people selling the Nazi memorabilia turn around and adopt some sort of euphemism for whatever it is they may happen to be selling. So, in short, I really think it's a very poorly thought-out ruling on the part of the French court, and I think they're completely out of their jurisdiction to try to impose these rules upon a U.S. company. A couple of months ago, I told about a case where a company sued Yahoo to find the identities of individuals who had posted messages critical of that company. The posters appeared to be employees of the company in question. According to an article from Ziff Davis, two of the four individuals whose identities were sought by Dendrite Software have successfully filed and won countersuits against Dendrite. This appears to be the first time anonymous posters have succeeded in blocking a request for a subpoena that would have forced a message board operator to turn over information that would divulge their identities. Judge Kenneth C. McKenzie of the New Jersey Superior Court in Morristown said that the posters should remain anonymous because Dendrite has failed to demonstrate that it was harmed by any of the posted messages. Dendrite remains at liberty to sue to determine the identities of the other two anonymous posters who have not filed countersuits. This is an important case in the field of whistleblowing. Had Dendrite been able to determine the identities of the two posters, surely professional consequences would follow, as they likely will for the remaining two posters. This next item comes to us from the National Lawyers Guild Center on Democratic Communications. which has been a champion of low-power FM and micro-radio stations nationwide for, I don't know, I forget how many years this goes back. I know it goes back to at least 6 or 7 years, probably further than that. But apparently what has happened is that the Congress has passed an omnibus budget act containing a rider which will gut the FCC's new low-power FM service, and it appears that President Clinton will sign the bill. This is the culmination of a year-long intensive lobbying campaign by the National Association of Broadcasters, which unfortunately has been given liberal cover by NPR's campaign against low-power FM. For more than 10 years, the Center for Democratic Communications has been involved with the defense of microbroadcasters who went on the air at the time when the FCC refused to license low-power stations. The CDC argued that those rules were unconstitutional and that the risk of losing in court was one factor in the FCC's changing its position and authorizing low-power FM. More than a year ago, in meetings with National Association of Broadcasters, the CDC pointed out that they would hurt established broadcasters if they killed low-power FM, also known as microradio. The NAB claimed that they were worried about interference from unlicensed broadcasters. The CDC countered by pointing out that they would be much better off accepting some competition for audience from these small stations, but knowing where the stations were and knowing that the FCC had assigned them to available frequencies. The CDC pointed out that if LPFM was killed, that they would be faced with many stations going on the air in an unpredictable way at unknown frequencies and unknown locations. Because the technology is cheap and readily available, LPFM will not disappear, no matter how much Congress, National Public Radio, and the National Association of Broadcasters try to kill it. For many, low-power FM remains the only means for local communities to have a voice. Disappointed as they are by this congressional refusal to allow a small experiment in media democracy, the CDC will look at possible legal challenges to Congress's unprecedented attack on community radio. Peter Frank, a member of the CDC, speculated that this new law may well be unconstitutional. Frank has added that laws passed by Congress are easier to challenge in the courts than regulations that are promulgated by agencies such as the FCC. This, they claim, is not over. And, of course, I would wish the CDC well on this particular crusade. I'm terribly disappointed in the Congress's decision, and also very disappointed by the likelihood that President Clinton will sign this. Hey, thanks for tuning in. My name is Chuck Ritter. You can email me at cjritter@nycap.rr.com. Higher quality copies of this program for broadcast can be downloaded from radioforall.net. Please feel free to redistribute or rebroadcast this program in any medium. Thanks for listening.